You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
Welcome to another episode of Just the Disc. My name is Brian Sauer. This is my podcast about Blu-rays. I have Miss Stephanie Crawford with me. She is always ready to talk movies, and I'm always looking forward to talking movies with her. Thank you for joining me, Stephanie.
You're welcome. I'm the Phantom of Just the Discs. I don't have a life, so I can do as many of these as you ask of me.
Oh my gosh, that is not what I meant, but thank you for that. So tonight we are talking about a couple Scream Factory Blu-rays, one of which I believe you hadn't seen. Am I right?
You're right.
Okay, and one I hadn't seen. We are talking about The House on Haunted Hill, the 1999 William Malone version, and we are also talking about Someone's Watching Me, the John Carpenter-directed TV movie from 1978. So, Stephanie, you seem to be a fan of House on Haunted Hill, and I had not seen it. Somehow, I thought I'd seen a lot of those, you know, remake things that were happening around this time. I saw Ghost Ship, I saw House of Wax, but somehow I didn't see this one. So thank you for, you know, just the fact that you were getting it made me go, oh, okay, I think I should see that. I'm curious about it.
This Halloween, six strangers have been invited to a party. If they can stay up till dawn, they'll win $1 million each. The only catch is that they'll have to live through the night.
Let the games begin.
So, what is it about this movie that sort of stands out to you? Are you a big fan of it, or are you just sort of medium fan of it?
No, I'm a really big fan of it. I had just started high school when this came out, and it was a really fun time to be like a new horror fan. I saw Scream in theaters when I was 12 or 13, and that started a little renaissance, and it was really popular, but it was really derided as well. I remember that even this time period, almost 20 years ago, I don't want to think about that. People were attacking something for being a remake, even though I'm not sure how many people were even familiar with William Castle who were attacking it. Who knows?
Almost none, I'm sure.
But I saw this in theaters, and I was really big on Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And so seeing Spike in the opening scene was a big deal. And I found out he wasn't actually British, which shook me. That's how I found out.
Okay.
Yeah, it came out. I had a lot of fun with it. It delivered a lot more than I was expecting it to. I got the DVD, and it's one of those ones I really glommed on to and would listen to the commentary like multiple times because that was super cool.
Yeah, no, I can't believe I missed it because it's really solid. Like, I was surprised. I think my expectations were still in a medium area because I'm like, I just don't know. I mean, although I'm a pretty big fan of the House of Wax remake. Ghost Ship is okay. Great opening scene, but you know, not as much on the rest. But I just wasn't sure what to expect. But this cast is like so strong. You've got Jeffrey Rush right around his Oscar-winning time playing, you know, the Vincent Price role. And it's interesting because William Malone, the director, who I got to know through this disc and who I think is a pretty cool guy based on what's here, it was neat to just sort of hear him go through the different actors that played the original roles and who sort of, there's a whole featurette about the two houses on Haunted Hill, that's kind of neat. And he sort of walks you through the different actors that play the different roles in the different versions. But anyway, I knew that you must appreciate Jeffrey Rush because he's playing the Vincent Price role, but he looks like somebody else. He looks like Vincent Price, but he also looks like somebody you like.
Yeah, he looks like my hero, John Waters.
Yeah, which is really neat because he's got the thin mustache. So immediately you go, oh yeah, he kind of looks like Vincent Price. But then you hear in the commentary and the interviews that he wanted to look like John Waters.
A lot of people have asked me about Jeffrey, you know, if he was playing Vincent Price, and actually he wasn't at all. His notion of the character was to do it sort of as John Waters, which I thought was kind of fun. And it's just the way it came off. You put Jeffrey Rush in John Waters outfits, and he becomes Vincent Price.
And it's pretty great. It works pretty well. And he is really good and eats up that role. And his wife is played by Famke Janssen, and she's great. Allie Larder is great. And in my notes, I just have...
Did you just list every actor equal sign great? Because you wouldn't be wrong.
Yes. Well, no, everyone else is not great. Taye Diggs is fine. Bridget Wilson is fine. Peter Gallagher's pretty good. Chris Kattan, pretty solid. Not quite great, but pretty solid. I think those top three are great. But no, I really miss Allie Larder. I remember a time when she was in so many movies, and now I don't see her in any movies. And I'm sad about that.
You miss Clear Rivers?
I miss Clear Rivers. Yeah.
That name always got to me. And you glossed over it, but John Waters is a huge William Castle fan, so that makes it extra special.
Totally does, and it totally makes sense. I wonder if that was in any way connected to Jeffrey Rush's choice, or if it was just aesthetics.
I'm just going to go with yes, absolutely. Okay. I feel like he consulted John maybe about the pencil mustache, and I was like, so what do you think about William Castle? I did notice... When you were talking about the Dark Castle remakes, you keep skipping over 13 Ghosts.
That's the one. Is that one any good? I can't remember. Is it bad?
Okay. So much like House on Haunted Hill, K&B does the effects.
Cool.
And the ghosts are incredible. Some of them are truly terrifying. And it takes place in a glass house. And it's a marvel. I don't even know how they work the cameras around it, but it's gorgeous. So you have these great effects, this great location, and one of the worst scripts with some of the worst acting and one of the most wooden characters of all time. So it's, I don't know. I think it'd be a good one to mute and like replace with your own dialogue.
You know, that might be the one that I did see that I may be associated with this one. That put me off watching this one permanently. Or maybe I was just like, well, if they're like that, I'm not going to watch it. So I think that's the one, but I can't remember if I've seen that or not. But I had forgotten about Dark Castle altogether. You know, Dark Castle being the production entity that is a combination of Joel Silver and Robert Zemeckis that was doing a lot of these movies, like you said, in the late 90s. And I do think it's interesting just that they even bothered to dig into these old classic horror films, you know? I mean, I'm going to put a lot of that probably on Robert Zemeckis, but I'm sure Joel Silver is a fan of that stuff too. But I did think it was a neat little movement that we had at that time.
Yeah, it was really cool. And I actually just wrote about this recently because a chunk of people who created Dark Castle came from Tales from the Crypt. So that's a big reason they knew who William Castle was. These are horror kids who are now super influential producers and directors. So it was almost like this really well-budgeted fan thing they did. And, you know, a little bit of an uneven output, but it's just such a cool idea. And it also has one of my favorite... You're in the business. What are the title cards called for a company like the cool Dark Castle logo that comes up?
I don't know. I just call them logos.
Okay.
I'm not
in business. Their logo.
Yeah, I do too. And speaking of Tales from the Crypt, if people haven't tried to check out your episode of the Pink Smoke podcast, which dropped recently. That is a Patreon exclusive that is really great. It's you and John Cribbs and Chris Funderburg talking about Tales from the Crypt. And it was great. It was a really, boy, I'm using that word a lot tonight. It was really entertaining and enjoyable and made me want to dig back into the show. Also tying into Tales from the Crypt, as you were saying that this is connected to that, William Malone mentions in both the commentary and the interview, I believe, that the inspiration for him even wanting to do this movie came from a Tales from the Crypt episode that he directed. I think it was not necessarily him wanting to do the movie, but him wanting to set it in an insane asylum. And I guess he had done Tales from the Crypt in an asylum overseas, and it was like a haunted place, and he was like, this is super creepy, and I think it sort of got in his head that he wanted to make a haunted house insane asylum movie, and so that was transposed onto this project, I believe.
The whole notion for the house really was, I was in England shooting an episode of Tales from the Crypt, and we had this really cool location that we used, and it was a former mental institution, and the basement of the place was just absolutely creepy. And the upstairs, of course, had been turned into a residence, but most of the house has sort of been untouched. And it still had this sort of weird, creepy 1920s, 1930s feel. And I just thought it was a great place to set a horror picture.
Yeah, that's so cool. I love that you can get little seeds of ideas on other projects and bring that. And yeah, I do like how many connections there are to Tales from the Crypt in this movie.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know back when I loved it as a teenager. So.
Yeah, I wish I had seen it back then. It was weird because like it's so 90s in the casting. I mean, because so many of these actors are just not working right now, which is sad to me. But I so associate a lot of them with a very prime period in my life where I was working at video stores, and so every movie that came out I had some awareness of, especially the bigger ones, and the actors were ever present for me, so it just reminds me of that time, and I just kept going, did I not see this? How could I not have seen this? I saw everything around it.
Yeah, that's impressive, working at a video store and avoiding this. And you mentioned Jeffrey Rush and his Oscar. They knew he was nominated while they were filming. And I guess William Malone was a little bit worried that he might act too uppity for it now. But apparently he was great to work with. He was fully in. And on the night of the Oscars, they were doing some effects on him. And he was willing to stay and possibly miss the ceremony to make sure they could finish it.
Yeah, he's a real pro. And he's great. God damn it.
Tony the Tiger over here.
He's really good in the film. Oh boy. He just really brings it in this particular performance, and he's well suited to kind of go over the top in a certain way, and I just like a lot what he's doing here. So he, you know, like I said, he plays the Vincent Price role. The basic idea is that he's like a amusement park mogul, I guess. He makes these really scary they're really interesting sort of rides, and then he sort of shows off a couple of them at the beginning of the movie, and they're kind of terrifying, and you know, sort
of incognita.
Yeah. But so he sort of sets up this idea, this gimmick of inviting some people over to this asylum, this former mental asylum, to spend the night. And if they make it, he's going to pay them $1 million each. And if anybody doesn't make it, you keep the rest of the money, I guess. But lo and behold, some kind of creepy force changes the guest list and invites 5 different people that he didn't intend on. And so they show up, and we sort of get their backstories and so forth. But, you know, it's entertaining to see these folks at work. And I think the way that William Malone sort of sets up the asylum and I don't want to give away too much, but I mean, one of the things he says in the, I want to say the featurette about the different houses, or maybe it's in his interview, is that one of the things that disappointed him about the original film was that there aren't any actual ghosts in the movie.
When we first started talking about the story, Dick Beebe and I and Joel and Bob Zemeckis, was that it was, when I was a child, I was sort of disappointed when I saw the original film that there were no real ghosts, because it's sort of advertised as a ghost movie. And we all thought it would be fun if we played with the notion that we don't know whether or not there's real ghosts or not. And of course, in our film, it turns out that there actually are ghosts.
And that he always thought it would be much cooler if there were, in that Matthew McConaughey kind of way. And so there are ghosts in this movie, and there are lots of creepy things in this movie, actually. And he does a really good job of being creepy for a late 90s movie like this. I find returning to some of them doesn't creep me out very much, but there's something about the way that he's approaching the material. I don't know. Can you speak to it? What is it about this movie that continues to make it still creepy today?
Well, it is interesting because you can tell it's from 1999. They have a lot of that effect they would do where someone would be walking a little jerkily towards you and they'd speed up really quick.
Oh, yeah.
Man, that seemed to happen a lot. I think Blair Witch 2, Book of Shadows, is usually the first one to come to mind. It does have some of that. It has a lot of Marilyn Manson in the soundtrack.
That's right.
But I feel like it's dated in a really charming way, because like we said, they started Dark Castle as fans. They were seriously into horror and they wanted to make a good horror movie. And I think William Malone always came at it with the right attitude. I remember reading an interview with him in Fangoria and he was just so enthusiastic about it. So I feel like it's just really thoughtful, and it really could have been like a quick, cheap cash in, but they really build a suspense about this house that became an asylum and then a house again. And like you said, it keeps you on your toes, because yes, there's ghosts, but there's almost, I don't know what you'd call some of them. They almost look like Silent Hill monsters.
Yeah.
Occasionally, like the one that gets or does it? I won't be able to avoid spoilers.
I think we're going to spoil just a little bit, at least.
Bridget Wilson. I think it's really skillful people. So even though it is stylish and there are definitely some casting choices that you can tell the studio is like, well, this person's hot right now, let's put them in. I just think there's too much talent and thoughtfulness and people who actually cared about horror. Like even something little I noticed on the extras was William Malone would talk about the special effects, and he knew everything about them. And directors will know generally what they want, because they need to be able to tell the creators what they want. But he knew like every little detail about it. I'm like, oh, that's the guy who's into this.
Yeah, there's a great story that he tells about one of the creepier creatures in the movie, where I don't know if it was something where Dick Smith created this monster. It's like a weird, I can't even just, how would you describe that thing? It's like all
its
mouth.
Its mouth takes over its entire head.
Yeah. It's all mouth, creepy, like thinning hair. It's really wispy. I don't know. It's scary. It's freaky. And he had seen it somehow in something that Dick Smith had worked on. Obviously, he's a big fan of Dick Smith, and that's really cool. And so he asked Dick if he could use this thing that I guess didn't get used in another movie. And Dick was like, well, yeah, you know, maybe you could give me a couple bucks. And he was like, of course. And so this monster, this face thing, is one of the creepier creatures in the movie. And it's, you know, an old Dick Smith repurpose. But William Malone is so excited that he has Dick Smith's name on the movie. You know, like you say, it's coming from this place of pure fandom, you know?
And that the son of the creature of the Black Lagoon was like one of the divers who helped out in that scene.
Yeah, Rico Browning Jr. Yeah, that's really cool too.
Yes.
Super cute to hear him talk about that stuff. Yeah, he's clearly just a guy who loves this kind of movie. Like he, you know, again, he talks about seeing House on Haunted Hill, I'm assuming probably in the theater or around the time it came out. Maybe he's not quite that old, but he clearly is an old horror fan from way back, and that's really cool. But yeah, there's some sequences in this movie. What's the thing, that chamber that Jeffrey Rush goes in?
It's like a weird zoetrope. chamber that's supposed to make you so insane it makes you sane again. But it's obviously a weirdo torture device made by sadists.
Yeah, it's really a disturbing scene, ultimately. I don't know. Jeffrey Rush just plays it really well in a way that I feel the emotional impact of him like losing his fucking mind, basically. And yeah, there's just something about that sequence that I've not seen too many things like that. And yeah, he just does some things. Like there's a part where Taye Diggs has to be sort of possessed, I guess. And he talked about a trick that he had seen back in, what other movie was it, with the light in the eyes?
Now, when she sees Taye down at the end of the hallway here, which I think this scene seems to play pretty well, what I wanted to do is have something that was off about Taye's look, and but nothing that was too drastic. So what we did is you saw his eyes glow there. I call that the Blade Runner effect, because it was I first saw it in any way in Blade Runner, and it's actually quite a simple effect. It's just a piece of glass in front of the camera that projects the light from the same angle as the camera lens, and basically you get that effect, the red eye effect you see in your pictures at home when they don't turn out well. It's a little tricky to align, but it gives you a really cool effect.
But it's just like, you know, him taking from other movies and things like that. I don't know. And then he's a big fan of Jeff Combs, who plays like the mad doctor in the movie. I mean, Jeff Combs doesn't have much, like he doesn't have a line, I don't think.
No. But he gets so effective, though.
Yeah, he gets to be like unsettling and weird and move in that, you know, way that you were talking about that they used to do in the 90s. But it's neat to have him in there. You wouldn't necessarily know it's him if you didn't pay attention, but I just think it's a neat like horror lineage thing to have him in there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing I was thinking of is when they go into the basement and they have those preserved bodies with plastination. And that always reminds me of Anatomy, that German horror movie, because they relied on that a lot too. And they have a permanent exhibit of that kind of thing here in Las Vegas. That's where they just like preserve. You can see like the nerves and the organs.
Wow.
And they basically look like jerkied people.
Yikes.
And it's really intense seeing it in person. But I was kind of wondering, like, how did that become a trend all of a sudden? And I looked it up, and this came out like right before Anatomy did. And then I was thinking about The Cell for some reason, because it did took off from the Damien Hirst like splitting the animal into slices thing. And I was like, I kind of missed that era of when they would just steal from pop art and throw it into horror movies. But I was looking up plastination, and it was invented in the 1970s, so it would actually not be in the basement of the movie. And it actually ruined the movie for me.
Oh, no. Well, that's weird, because he was talking in the commentary about some doctor that had done that stuff that was based on something real. But I guess he didn't say when. I assumed it was, I thought he said the 1930s. But
I'm sure there are other forms and probably really sophisticated things you could do with formaldehyde even decades and decades and decades ago. But
yeah. No, but that is a great little bit of set dressing that, again, in the commentary, he mentions, you know, them having to walk by that stuff over and over again, and you kind of keep thinking it's going to, like, come to life at some point, and I won't give away if it does or not, but, yeah, it's a fun little bit that definitely adds to the mood of the overall piece. But anyway, I think one thing that is a bummer for the movie, being from 1999, is that, and I have to admit that I did the same thing I think a lot of people do, which is you look at the ghost sequences at the end and you go, oh, that's just really bad CG, when in fact it's not. And it's some really interesting composite work where they use like naked women covered in, I don't know what, black and tree branches and different stuff, and then people's faces to create this like giant glob wind ghost that is really unsettling and cool. But on first glance, I was like, oh, that just doesn't look as good anymore. And then watching all the special features, which you should probably go into now that we're getting to the nitty gritty here, it would really gave me a second appreciation for the movie. And I was just like, wow, I feel bad for this movie because I got suckered, and I'm sure a lot of people will going back to it, you know, because it's just the right kind of compositing that you could mistake for bad CG, when in fact it's really interesting craftsmanship.
Yeah, I was really glad they showed that and went into it, because I can tell you, as someone who saw it in the theater when it was brand new, I thought, wow, that's terrible CGI, even back then. I remember that very distinctly. I was falling in love with the movie. I was thinking, this is the perfect horror movie. And then that happened. And I was just like, you have these amazing effects, these amazing practical effects, and then you throw that up there. Now, of course, I know better now. I still don't love it. It kind of looks like a giant moth person thing to me. But I do appreciate the creative ingenuity and the originality that went into it, but I still don't completely love it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you, because I can't deny my initial reaction, and that at this point I was creeped out while still being slightly taken out, so it just dulled the effect a little bit. And that last, the ending bit is pretty cool, because some people are getting their shit fucked up, and so it was a bummer to sort of be pulled out at that point a little bit. And then there's a point with Chris Kattan that I messaged you about, uh-huh, that really took me out. But that's whatever. So anyway, the features are really solid, I thought. And again, like I said, made me sort of reevaluate the movie, which I liked, but made me like it more. So you've got a new exclamation point in the Scream Factory way, William Malone interview, which is about 37 minutes. And he just goes through the making of the film.
The sequences that people remember a lot from that is the Jeffrey Combs shot, where Jeffrey Rush is watching him on a monitor, and you see Jeffrey Combs walking kind of this weird way. What we do is we rehearse the scene first at normal speed, and I'd have a continuity person hold a stopwatch, and we'd time how long it took for somebody to do an action. Then I'd say, okay, now we're going to run the camera at 6 frames a second. And she'd calculate how long that would take. Now we're going to have to shoot it for like a minute or something like that. And he walks very, very slowly. And we're shooting at 4 frames a second. Now, when you run it at normal speed, it gives it this kind of weird, twitchy quality. And then I said, okay, and then I want you to bring the knife out. And I said, I want you to go like that. And he did that really quick. It gives it this otherworldly quality, which, again, it was one of those things that the producers got, what are we paying for these effects for? He didn't pay for it.
He just seems like a really cool guy. Like, I just, mm-hmm, want to hang out with him.
I do, know? Too. William Malone, if you're listening to this, please hang out with us.
Yes. He said at one point, I just wrote down, says Jeffrey Combs is like Peter Cushing. I'm like, that's fucking cool. That makes sense.
Yeah. And he hated Klaus Kinski when he worked with him. And I know he has some terrible horror stories about him.
Yikes. Yeah, I'll bet. But yeah, just hearing him talk so passionately about all the actors involved and about the approach to the effects and everything, like I said, just really makes me want to see. I haven't seen Fear.com. I haven't seen some of his other work. So now I want to sort of go and check out some of his other stuff based on just this interview and this movie.
Yeah, I don't think Fear.com is considered a lost classic very much. But hey, you never know what's worth rediscovering or discovering long after it's been torn apart. So
yeah. He did say something about this being the first big horror movie released on Halloween. I can't believe that's true, but he made it sound like before that, for some reason, they weren't releasing horror movies on Halloween. And then from this point on, it started to become a thing.
Yeah, I don't really have the research on there.
Yeah, it's hard to tell if it's something. He seems like a guy who's pretty together with, and that he wouldn't just make something like that up. So, because he seemed genuinely shocked himself that it hadn't been done,
yeah,
at least based on what he was saying. So if that's true, that's intriguing. That's very intriguing.
That is. Saw. I hope you're giving appreciation.
What else did you take anything else away from this interview?
No, just that I was so familiar with the old DVD that was really cool to see an updated interview with him. And I'm so glad he's still affectionate about it. I would feel pretty bummed out if he was like, oh, that cash grab. Yeah.
No, he clearly still has the passion for it. The next thing that's also new is a special effects. I don't know if he was a supervisor, but his name's Robert Skotak. And this was, I took your advice to heart, which is always watch the special effects featurettes on these releases, which I had gotten out of doing for some reason. And this one in particular is great because, again, it's so much practical work. He, you know, talks about the model work that they did to represent the house itself, which is a combination of models and the front of the observatory. What am I thinking of? Griffith Park, for God's sake. So it's a combination of model work and the front part of the Griffith Park Observatory, which apparently a lot of people don't see. They're used to seeing the dome and the front entrance to it. But this backside of it is, it's not exactly like off a cliff or anything like that because they're doing a lot of matte painting and other things. But it does give the impression of a different building entirely. And the building that they've come up with is pretty iconic, I have to say. Just looking at the cover, you know, the way that it towers above this cliff that it's sort of emerging from, I don't know, that adds to the mythos of the movie for me in a big way.
Yeah, in the original, which I'm a huge fan of, the house is iconic. It still is today. And I think they added on to it in a way that added its own character rather than just being like, 90s bombastic, we have to make it bigger.
To the extreme.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, the original house, I think, is a Frank Lloyd Wright house. I forget what it's called, but I think it's the one that they use in like The Big Lebowski, and I don't know, I want to say it's been used in some other movies, at least the interiors. But apparently they thought about using that house, but I guess the neighborhood has developed and the background area behind it has developed in such a way that it didn't have the same gravitas to them. And I'm glad that they went ahead, like you said, and made this new building as part of the
Ennis house.
Oh yeah, there you go.
How far are you from Los Feliz? You should go check it out. Take some pictures.
I could. I mean, I am about an hour and a half or so, vaguely. But yeah, I should totally go by. It's been used in a lot of movies, so, or at least a few that I can think of that would make it a place I'd want to stop by. So yeah, he goes through that stuff. He goes through the ghost creature moth thing, talking about how they did that. He goes through a bunch of different sequences in the movie. The chamber thing we were talking about before, he talked about that. What else did he talk about?
Lots of stuff. Like everything.
Yeah, he goes through basically every big effect set piece sort of thing in the movie, and it's about an 18-minute interview. But yeah, he covers a lot of ground. He's the one who tells the story about Jeffrey Rush staying late and posing to match an effects shot on the night of the Academy Awards. So that's really cool. But yeah, it was just really neat to hear. This guy just seems like a really kind of maybe slightly odd, but fascinating dude, like an artist, you know, like somebody that reminded me like of Tim Burton or something like that. I don't know, just in terms of his craft and how he approached it. What do you think of him?
I think like a lot of special effects artists, he's interesting. He's intense. he's very knowledgeable and passionate. He takes it seriously while still having kind of a sense of humor about it. That's why I recommend special effects and makeup artists interviews to you. Like they seem to generally have incredible memories.
Yeah.
And they have to deal with everyone. They deal with the directors. They deal with the actors. So they tend to always have good stories.
That's true. I mean, these are things I hadn't thought about in terms of the practicality of what they'll bring to a disc like this. And so that's good advice. Watch these featurettes. So then I think a lot of the other stuff is ported over. Oh, there's a composer interview, which I did not watch. I apologize. Did you watch it?
I did. Yeah.
What'd you think?
It's pretty simple. He seems a little less passionate about it than the other guys, maybe slightly cynical.
Yeah.
But if you're kind of interested in how they would construct music for horror movies in that time period, it's interesting because it seemed like there are a lot of specifics they had to work with.
Cool. I think that's the last new interview, and then a lot of the other stuff is coming over from the DVD, including the William Malone commentary you talked about, which is good, but is very screen specific. I felt like if you're looking for something like me, sometimes I like to listen to commentaries separate from watching the movie. And this one you can, but I feel like he's really very much watching the movie with you and commenting on it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good track. Then there's this thing called Tale of Two Houses, I think I mentioned before, where they literally go through both movies and kind of show the different houses. They show different scenes with like Vincent Price and his wife playing a scene and Jeffrey Rush and Famke Janssen playing a scene. And they just work through the whole movie, and William Malone talks about different things that, you know, he remembers from the two different approaches to the material.
Both pictures have their own Watson Pritchett, the strange owner of the house.
The thing, the evil, the thing that's the rotten core at the bottom of this place, the thing that's going to kill us all.
Destroys everything with hair and flesh. Just leaves the bones.
Elijah Cook Jr., who you might remember from Maltese Falcon, who plays the Gunsel in Maltese Falcon, he plays the Pritchett character in the original film. And he has this kind of slightly demented quality to him.
This is what she used on my brother and her sister.
And we, you know, when we got Chris Kattan to come on board, he sort of had that quality as well as being very funny.
I'm just a little bit uncomfortable with this. I'm sure you are.
He doesn't really play it for laughs. He's just funny because he's Chris. And he plays it actually fairly straight as this guy who's just right on the edge of a nervous breakdown, which with Chris is hysterically funny.
So what, we're stuck here forever?
Cleaning crew's supposed to come in at 9:30 in the morning.
Jeez.
Oh, so then we'll just stay here till morning.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll be mutilated beyond recognition by then.
Joys of a public domain movie.
That's right.
So you can include all those clips. I will say...
I forgot about
that. Yeah, Famke Janssen and her chemistry with Jeffrey Rush, it does justice to the original one with Vincent Price, and I think it's Carol Omart. They have that acidity and that banter, and I think that's probably the most difficult thing to pull off in the remake, and it's wonderful. So I have to mention that because it might be my favorite part of the movie.
Gave you a goddamn guess that's 2 pages long. Where the hell are they?
Shredded. Sorry. Decided to whip up one of my own. A group so hungry for money they'd be willing to do anything. I thought you'd be more comfortable with your peers.
It was stupid of me not to expect something this twisted from you. Congratulations. Round one, you win.
Not quite. See those people down there? They're not the ones I invited.
Yeah, then who are they?
You tell me. I don't know how you managed to hack into my computer, but bravo.
Come on. You think I invite that bunch of social rejects?
Sure, no, it wasn't me. And if you say it wasn't you, then who the hell did, Evelyn? Ghosts.
Ooh, spooky. You know, if you really love me, you find a way to drop dead in the next 3 seconds.
Finding ways for me to die is really your deal, isn't it, Evelyn? Let's not forget the OJ knife with the not quite retractable blade. Your Jim Jones Kool-Aid that was exactly that.
Accidents. All accidents until proven otherwise.
I'd be so happy if that were really true, Evelyn. I'm positively goddamn delirious if you weren't fucking every living thing in our area code.
Which part of that fantasy turns you on the most? Me with other men? Or just the other men?
Everything you do gets me hot, just not in the sexual sense.
You're hurting me.
I know. Ow! Well, there's the simple country gal I married. Let's go back down and greet your guests, show them the real you. Corny as Kansas on the 4th of July.
My guests were shredded. It's your sick little scene now. Enjoy. I'm gonna run scalding water on the place you just touched me. And then I'm calling a cab.
I think I might be with you. Chris Kattan is pretty good, although he's mostly playing it straight and annoyed, which is, I find funny. I find people that are really annoyed and vocal about it sometimes very funny. And he's like annoyed and vocal from the very beginning. I missed that apparently he's like living in his car because he, where did I hear? I heard this in one of the features. The character is living in his car because he inherited the house and he has to pay the taxes on it and no one will buy it. So he's basically been drained of all his money. And that's part. And so he's just trying to get somebody to pay him to use the house. And that's why he's so irritated about not getting his check and is basically a dick from the like word go, just totally cranky. And it's pretty entertaining, I have to say. But yeah, it's not as good as Jeffrey Rush and Famke. They're amazing together. And then, let's see, what else? There's a visual effects vintage featurette. You said the deleted scenes are something that should be watched on this one in particular.
Right. We've discussed before that neither one of us are usually big on deleted scenes because they were deleted for a reason.
Exactly.
I really like these ones, though, because one, William Malone introduces them, each one, and talks about why it didn't make it.
Oh, that's cool.
And they're actually really good scenes. They just literally don't really fit the tone of the movie. So it was cool seeing them because they're actually really done and enjoyable on their own, but they were absolutely right to cut them. So there's actually two completely different takes shot on completely different locations with different extras about how Ali Larter's character got her ticket.
Oh.
Because her boss is played by Debbie Mazur.
Oh,
she's
man.
A big bitch. Yeah, and she fires her. And she's like, all
I
right.
love Debbie Mazur.
Yes, and she's amazing in these like tiny little scenes. So it sets that up, and they're just in two completely different locations because they like change their mind. So that's interesting too, to see the different deliveries. And then there's one with zombies.
Whoa.
And this was before the big zombie renaissance. We weren't really seeing a whole lot of zombies in like major motion pictures around this time. So it's literally like a pit of really good looking zombies. It's so much work that didn't make it to the screen.
Aww.
And the last scene, I won't give it away. They had to cut it because if they cut the first Debbie Mazur scene, there's no way this one would make sense. But it has Jeffrey Combs and Debbie Mazur together.
Whoa. Damn, that's a scene I totally want to watch now.
Yeah, and it's like the entire thing's 11 minutes. So.
Oh, that's cool. Nice and short. Yeah, I'm going to check that out. I didn't get a chance. So thank you for recommending it because, as we've said before, sometimes we're both meh on those. So that's pretty much it for The House on Haunted Hill. Or, I'm sorry.
Just House. No definite article.
Just House.
Just House.
Yes. Just House on Haunted Hill. And so next up we have a Blu-ray of John Carpenter's Someone's Watching Me from 1978.
Wednesday. I'll find you. I don't give up.
I'm going to go to the police.
I already did that.
Well, this time it's my turn.
Lauren Hutton, David Burney, and Adrian Barbeau. She has everything to live for, but someone wants her dead. Someone's Watching Me, right after Dick Clark Wednesday on NBC.
I always want to say Somebody to Watch Over Me, the Tom Berenger movie.
I was going
to
say, you sounded very unsure.
Yeah.
Almost like someone's look over my shoulder, watching me.
No, it's this literal thing that I have to do every time I say the title of this movie, because my brain and mouth want to say Somebody to Watch Over Me, even though I know that's not this movie. It's literally something that the flow of that phrase, for whatever reason, is the one that my brain wants to go with. So anyway, this is a TV movie. He did it in 1978. Apparently, according to the wonderful commentary from Amanda Reyes, he actually made this movie before Halloween. And it ended up coming out I want to say about a month after Halloween hit theaters. Mm-hmm. But I had always placed it as after Halloween because of its release date, which I should have thought was maybe not accurate. But yeah, so there's a really interesting, and it's mentioned in the commentary, approach that he takes that ends up being a lot of similar things to Halloween, actually, which I'm sure you noticed.
I did notice that, and it was really interesting to see that, actually, because it's such a different medium. It's, well, less so today, I guess, but back in the 70s, absolutely. And seeing kind of those slasher flourishes and what would become iconic done maybe slightly more casually in this one. Yeah, as a big John Carpenter fan, it's like a wonderful little treat to see that develop.
Yeah, it's. I'm so glad that you hadn't seen it and you got to watch it the first time like this, because it looks great. And it's a fun little thriller. For those that don't know, it's basically Lauren Hutton plays a woman. What does she do at the TV station? She like a producer or something?
Yeah, she...
I couldn't really...
I think so. Yeah, she's like brand new. She's starting a new job.
Okay. So she moves to LA. She is in a high-rise apartment. This movie was actually called High Rise at one point. And it's across from another high-rise. And we get to see the very beginning of the movie, which is kind of, you know, the end of the story before this, where this guy is stalking this woman from one building to another. He's spying on her with a telescope. He's calling her and hanging up. He's calling her and talking to her, even creepier. And so we get to see that sort of play out before she moves in, and then he goes after her, and it becomes the, you know, proverbial cat and mouse. But there's a lot of good, not necessarily total, I don't want to call it all self-awareness, but there does seem to be a sense of like, I've seen a few Hitchcock movies and I know what people are expecting, and I'm going to try and play against that or do something a little different. And I think that makes it feel good overall.
I agree. Can you just do me a favor and say what the lead actress's character's name is?
Her name is... Oh, it's Lee... What's her
last name?
It
doesn't matter. I always feel like somebody's watching Lee. Had to do it. I'm sorry.
That is awesome. Well done.
It's
well
Michael. Done. It doesn't matter.
Lee Michaels, that's right. And there is some talk in the commentary, and I feel like somewhere else, I can't remember where I saw it, that this could be a reference to Lee Brackett, which is a name he would go on to use directly in Halloween. Chuck Cypher's character, I believe, is named Lee Brackett. And he loves Howard Hawks, and he loves her as a screenwriter on a bunch of movies, so it seems logical that she could be named after Lee Brackett. But she's a really neat character that is, I don't know, kind of a little odd, but has like a very determined personality, but is very fun, and I don't know, I just like the character. I just think she's a really neat person.
I loved her character. And yeah, it easily, she's like, Lauren Hutton was a model. That's what she was known for. I think this was her first acting job. So they easily could have just gotten a beautiful model and put her in a high rise and be like, oh, a beautiful woman's vulnerable. Isn't that scary? But she's really funny. Like, they point out what a funny person she is. She's a great friend. She's very independent. She's actualized. She tries to figure out what's going on by herself, but not in a stupid way. She's constantly trying to get the cops to take her seriously, and they're not. So she's like, great, I get to figure this out. Thanks a lot, guys. And I think it makes it a lot scarier, because if you have a dumb character stumbling through everything, of course terrible things are going to happen to them. It's kind of easy to make it happen to them. But she's so clever, and yet she's still, again and again, this guy finds a new way to terrorize her. At some point, we're relating to her and caring about her so much. We're like, you're doing everything right, and he's still right there. What are we going to do? Adrian Barbeau, help her out.
Yeah, Adrian Barbeau is great in the movie, too. And there's obviously a really neat thing about her character, in that she plays an openly gay character, and it is addressed, but it is not dwelled on, and it's just sort of a thing that is in this movie, and it feels really, really progressive for the time it came out. And I think Carpenter, I can't remember if she said Carpenter was proud of it, but I know that she was proud in the interview, that there's a new interview on the disc with Adrienne Barbeau, and she talks about being proud to have played that character, which was really early in terms of that kind of representation on television.
Yeah, I love the way they reveal it. It's just really casual, and it's most like, yeah, not him, her, basically.
Yeah.
And Lauren Hutton's like, oh, okay, cool. Yep. You know, let's go hang out. Totally. It's great. I am a big fan of how John Carpenter portrays women in his film, which is basically they're human beings. They're people. They're characters just like the male characters.
Yep.
And that shouldn't be a thing I would ever need to point out. But I don't know, like, especially in the 70s, like, you know, you'd have a beautiful actress, but you'd be like, yeah, put her in a sweater, throw a vest on her. She's running around in jeans and a giant trench coat. Like, why would she be wearing something slinky right now? She wouldn't. She's smart. She has hobbies. It's just, it seems like a small thing, but he always seems to be attracted to writers and actresses who are interested in not playing archetypes.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it comes from who he is. It obviously partially comes from loving Howard Hawks films, which,
oh yeah,
while, you know, aren't necessarily towering examples of progressive, they tend to be more so than a lot of films that are contemporary to them.
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah.
Yeah, I love the female characters in Howard Hawks movies. They're really just right up my alley. Absolutely. They have agency and drive and intelligence and charisma and charm and determination. They have all these things that really, I don't know, just make them really neat people.
And he wasn't afraid to sometimes give them the funniest line. Yep. And John Carpenter isn't afraid of that either.
Yeah, it's crazy that,
and a lot of male directors won't do that, yeah, or writers.
It's too bad because I tend to like movies more that do it, you know. And I like the, I mean, you could call it bravery, but courage, whatever, that the Lee Michaels character demonstrates in the movie. She, again, agency. She has a lot of it in this movie, just in terms of, like, she has mechanical know-how. She is not intimidated by machines. She, you know, approaches a guy in a bar and starts hitting on him. You know, she goes straight at the killer in a couple instances, or the stalker, excuse me. So she's really, I don't know, she's got a lot of chutzpah, as it were, and and I really like it.
Yeah, no, she's a fun character to go through this journey on, and which is great because there was kind of a trend of women getting phone calls with a mysterious man watching and threatening them. And, you know, it's not that they'd all be weak characters or anything, but the story was just to be scared for a vulnerable woman. And this is more like, okay, like, what if we put, like, an intelligent person in this situation? You know, what if we don't make it easy and she has to figure it out? She has some good friends, but she has to figure it out on her own. And I thought that made it, what could have been kind of creepy and exploitative, actually made it kind of fun in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a really entertaining thriller in, I mean, I hate to bring Hitchcock in again, but I mean, there's a bunch of Hitchcock going on here, and it's clear, although Carpenter, you know, says Hawks before Hitchcock, he clearly likes Hitchcock.
That'd be a great t-shirt. I'm sorry, Hawks before Hitchcock.
I want that. I would wear that. He does an homage to the North by Northwest Saul Bass title sequence right out of the gate. So he's clearly not ashamed of the Hitchcock homages. And then there's a really sharp direct rip of a section of Rear Window. I mean, the whole thing is Rear Window-ish, but then there's a whole bit that they take from Rear Window. So, you know, it's trying to be classy. It's trying to be an elegant, sophisticated thriller, and I think it pulls it off. So you dug it though. This was a nice first time watch for you.
Oh, I loved it. Nice. I'm a John Carpenter fan and I've heard really good things about it, but I tried to manage my expectations. I'm like, well, it was a TV movie, you know, they probably had a short production time and a small budget and everything. No, it completely delivers.
That's cool. I'm so glad you thought so.
I didn't need to adjust my expectations.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because you hadn't seen it. I'm thinking there are a lot more people who haven't, because I think you've seen most movies that are good. That's how I feel about you. So,
there's a lot.
You deliver that sort of that reputation. So if you haven't seen it, I feel like there's a lot that haven't. And so it's really neat that this came out in a Scream Factory Blu-ray, because you know, these things are very collectible and horror fans are aware of the label. And I think even...
But there's not a slipcover, man.
Anyway, yeah, it doesn't have a slipcover, but it's still a really neat movie. And, you know, a lot of people love John Carpenter, but I think there are plenty that are like, I'm good. I've seen all the good stuff. I don't need to go back to that cheesy 70s TV movie. Well, yes, you do, because it's solid. It's really, really enjoyable, and it shows you where he's going, and you do see a lot of, you know, creative approaches that he's going to then use for Halloween.
Yes.
Shortly after. So
I love that shot. I'm sorry. It's like a morning after, and she gets a creepy call where he's like, I like you better without the robe. Get rid of it. Yeah. And she goes from having this great evening to him immediately stealing that from her. And there's actually a great line where Adrian Barbeau basically says, like, well, why isn't it rape? It's when a man consciously leaves a woman in fear. And you see that in her face where all the joy she just had just drains. And she drops the phone and she runs into the bathroom. And the camera is right above the bathroom. And you just see her in the corner next to the toilet, like between the shower and the toilet, just huddling. And then it cuts to commercial break. Well, where a commercial break would have been. And it's like, holy, that is pulling off so much. And then there's probably like a detergent commercial immediately after that.
Yeah, you were talking about how well he uses the commercial breaks. I think I saw you tweet about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's one example. I feel like there's a couple others where the breaks come at like a perfect story beat point that helps, you know, that moment resonate. And I think that's pretty cool. I just feel like that's an intelligent thing. It's not like he's the first to ever do it, but he's just a thoughtful filmmaker. So he's just like, well, I have to do this thing. How can I do it in such a way as to, you know, make the film better or make it more enjoyable for the audience, you know?
You know what I think it is? I think Carpenter is very respectful of fear and what fear does to people and how they respond to fear. Because it's the same way with Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, where as an audience, he brings us into the space with them. They're never othered, you know? We're never really separated them in a way like, oh, she's the victim. What's going to happen to her? Like in a lot of slashers. They're like, oh, no, do you see her? She's this intelligent young woman. She has friends. She has a family. She has a life. And we're going to be in this closet with her. We're going to be in this bathroom with her. And you're going to experience that fear because it's real. And I don't know, it's almost like a really subtle way of jamming empathy into, you know, they're great classic kind of horror set pieces, but, you know, I never feel like he's taking advantage of the characters. I feel like he really wants you to be like, yeah, enjoy this. It's a fun scare, but, you know, this woman literally thinks she's going to die. Like, give her some respect, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and he does, in this particular movie, he does something cool with her, which is that she talks to herself, which is another sort of quirky characteristic that's really endearing.
I do that.
I do too. It's just really endearing that she does it, but it's also very intimate, and so she's like narrating for you, talking to you, even though she's talking to herself. You're getting a voiceover narration, but it's even more personal because it's delivered on screen and it's a private moment that, you know, you feel like she wouldn't necessarily say those things if other people was around. If other people were around, she probably
not
would.
Like other people was around.
She probably would say those things, but it's just one of those moments, especially if you do talk to yourself like you and I do. I don't do it. I mean, in my head, it's like the movie that's happening, that it's like the Truman Show or something, I guess, where like in some cosmic level, somebody's laughing at some stupid joke that I made to my dog that no one else can see. But
I like that.
You like that?
Do you think that's why we podcast so much, though, so it's more socially acceptable?
It must be. It's definitely something. But yeah, so that's just a really personal thing, I think. And so that really brings you into the character a little bit more right from the very beginning. And yeah, but he does have that, like, I think you're right. I think it's something about his feelings about fear and the concept of fear and how it's relatable and where that comes from. I mean, he's so nuts and bolts when he talks about stuff. It almost feels like if you brought it up to him, he'd be like, ah, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, he just blew it off, but clearly there's something there.
Well, of course, that's just a personality type, but he's like an ultra creative in that he's a very talented musician on top of everything else. Like, if you don't care and you don't put anything beyond surface level thought, you can't create what he has created through the decades. So I kind of love that about him. He's like, yes, let's get into the craft. He's kind of like, ah, whatever. I kind of love that. And I think that's part of why people love revisiting his work and dissecting and writing about it, because, you know, he, like you say, he's nuts and bolts, especially when he does commentaries with like Kurt Russell. And like, if he talks about anything a little bit seriously, they'll just start making fun of him about it and just start laughing. And I don't know. I think that just adds to the fun of rewatching and be like, okay, John, you're not going to help me out. I'll figure out what you were trying to get to with this one, you know?
Yeah. I just always forget, when I'm not watching the big iconic films, how much I just love him as a filmmaker. Like, he's legitimately one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. And I certainly am not shy about saying things like that, but sometimes you get into a movie and you're just like, oh wait, yeah, this is this guy that I love, and here's why I love him. It's like you forget, or at least I do sometimes. I'm like, oh yeah, this is a John Carpenter movie. Because it's, like I said, it's not one of those ones with his name in front of the title, you know?
It's the danger of being too good is we're going to probably take you for granted.
That's true. So yeah, solid thriller. And I like the features on this disc. The commentary, as I mentioned, Amanda Reyes, she's the author of a book called Are You in the House Alone? A TV Movie Compendium, 1964 to 1999. She is an all-around wizard and expert when it comes to TV movies. She has a podcast called Made for TV Mayhem, which is great. And they mostly, I think they only talk about TV movies. And she knows so much about these that, like, whenever I hear her talk and she's talking about some, for me, obscure actor that's in a lot of TV movies, she just sounds like a professor. She sounds like somebody where I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea what you're talking about, but you're clearly really in deep on this stuff and it's really infectious. So she's really good, and this commentary is really thorough and goes into all kinds of stuff from, I'm trying to think, like, from the actors, thematic elements she touches on, Carpenter's place and things he's doing stylistically. I don't know. She just goes over a lot of material. What did you think?
I loved it. She found a great balance of being academic and also part of why I love her Twitter feed is she'll bring up a more obscure television actor and just kind of moon over him. But in a really intelligent way. So she'll go into this great discussion of like how Lee is subverting the male gaze, and she'll be like, oh, but isn't he adorable in this? I could just watch these two talk. And so she finds this great balance of giving like great behind the scenes information, really interesting film theory bits, and then just she's just a fan who loves this stuff. Yeah. And it's really fun to listen to. And if you're like Brian and you're not super into the scene-specific commentary, then this one will probably appeal to you more.
Yeah, it's very much my kind of commentary in that way. I mean, she goes into details about like what Someone's Watching Me was up against the night that it aired. And then she talks about a whole bunch of other TV movies that Carpenter wrote, a lot of which, I mean, I can go and look at his IMDb page and I have, but for some reason these didn't register with me. And she talks about all this TV work that he did and what those movies, when they aired, were up against and what kind of a rating share all these shows did. And it's really fascinating stuff, just all the detail that's in there. So I am really excited by the fact that a lot of these TV movies are coming out on Blu-ray. We have a succession of this one, and then Night Stalker and Night Strangler, Trilogy of Terror. I feel like there's some other ones coming. Bad Ronald. So these TV movies are coming out, and what I'm hoping is that we'll see her get asked to do more commentaries because she is the authority and that is how it should be. So I'm excited to hear more commentaries from her on these.
Yes, though it's interesting she did a commentary for Last House on the Left with Bill Ackerman from Supporting Characters.
I love Bill. Yeah, she did a great interview on Supporting Characters, actually. Mm-hmm. Definitely go, if you haven't listened to Bill's interview with Amanda Reyes, go listen to that. That's great. But yeah, it is interesting that they did that track together, which sadly I've not heard yet, but I cannot wait because I know I'm going to like it probably more than I like the movie. I'm yeah, medium on the movie.
I wasn't going to buy it until I heard they did the commentary. I'm like, oh, okay, if they're with me, I can do it.
Exactly. And that's a big reason why I need to pick it up and will pick it up very soon. Anyway, so that's great. If that's all that was there, that'd be perfect. But then they have a new interview with Adrian Barbeau. I want to say it's about 11 minutes. And I love Adrian Barbeau.
All good people do.
So it's a very enjoyable time.
And also, like you mentioned, if there are some quote-unquote John Carpenter fans who think they don't need to see this, you're not a real John Carpenter fan if you know there's a movie he made with Adrian Barbeau and you're not going to see it.
You are right.
And this was before they were romantically together, too. So
yeah. No, she's great in the movie. It's a great Q&A. I just think she's a classy lady. And so she talks about getting cast, and I guess, I can't remember if she said that Carpenter, I think, had seen her on Maud or something like that. That was her big TV thing that she had been on, and she was doing theater work. And she says something about one of the big things that he did for her was she would play a scene and she'd play it kind of big because she was coming from this other way of doing things, basically. And he'd be like, that was great. Just do less.
I do credit John with giving me the best piece of acting advice I had had to date. We made the film in 1978. I had been on Broadway. I had done a half-hour sitcom for 6 years. I'd done a lot of other television movies and other guest stars on series and everything. And we did the first scene.
Your new home.
Now wait.
I can't, you can't.
Where am I? Just forget everything?
And John said to me, that was great, that was great. Do less. And I said, do less? And he said, yeah, do less. And it was like the light bulb going off, you know? Oh my gosh, that is the difference in the technique I need when I'm transitioning from half-hour sitcom, which was done like a play, or from Broadway, you know, do less. And that has served me well, and I'm very grateful for that man.
You know, because she's obviously really talented, and I think she just needed to be told it's okay to bring it down, and that she's great.
Yes.
I'm trying to think. Do you remember anything else that she said in the interview? I feel like there's some other good bits in there.
Well, she went into how much it meant to her to portray a lesbian character who is just a person, right, and that people still come up to her at conventions and let her know it was just cool to see a relatable character like that, especially back then.
Yeah, it must have been huge. Yeah, in 1978. For people struggling with, you know, their identities and coming out or not, to see something like that would have been, I think, really a big deal. And yeah, I just like her a lot. I love Adrienne Barbeau. So that's a fun little interview. And then there is a new interview with Chuck Cyphers. It's about 10 minutes where they basically talk him through his entire working career with John Carpenter. And he doesn't necessarily have a ton to say. Sometimes it's basically like, it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Chuck Cyphers, so I loved hearing him say anything about any of the movies he's done. I was fully there.
Yeah, it was fun just seeing someone kind of casually list off all the iconic John Carpenter movies he's been in. Yeah, it's like a fun little actor interview.
Yeah. Yeah, I would lose my shit a little bit if I saw him. Like, that's how much of a Carpenter nerd I am. But I'm sure there's a lot of people that would recognize him because he's in so many good movies. So that's fun. There's a thing from the DVD that's ported over called John Carpenter Director Rising, where he speaks to his memories of the film and where it came from and what he was doing at the time. And I think he talks about the actors too. I can't remember, but it's a fun little featurette.
So I wrote it as a feature, and this was 1977, the year before I made it. And it was a little, I guess, for the time, a little soft for them, or they didn't have enough to it. So it turned over to the TV department, and my agents had gotten me an agreement when I wrote it to be considered as director. And so they hire me. By this point in my career, I had directed two things only, Dark Star and Assault on Precinct 13, so I was green. I'd never worked on a union show. I got to know Ruben Cannon, who was the casting director at Warner's, became a long, long friend and a collaborator. We've done a lot of movies together. We started casting the movie. I cast Lauren Hutton, and she was just interesting to me. She was a model, and she'd acted in a couple of things. I wanted to see if I could, you know, get a performance out of her that was just something she hadn't done, and she was very interested in it.
Do you like that one?
Oh, I did. He actually brightened up a lot. I think he doesn't get asked about this one as much as he does others, and he seemed excited, also proud of it. It was cool to see that enthusiasm from him, and specifically talking about how he used similar techniques in Halloween. It was actually one of my favorite short Carpenter interviews.
You're totally right. He is into this one in a bigger way than he is on some, like, just having watched the Memoirs of an Invisible Man interview, you know, he's clearly not as fully invested in that. But yeah, it's something to be proud of. It's a really unforgettable little movie, and it must have been a really big deal to him. I mean, he makes Dark Star, he makes Assault, and then he gets this TV gig, which is, I'm sure, a lot more high pressure. Well, I'm sure it's all high pressure, but you've got more, I think it was ABC, you've got studio people breathing down your neck. It's a much more regimented schedule and setup, and it must be a lot harder to sort of fight for the creative things that you want to do, I would think. So it must have seemed like quite a victory to go through, you know, the quasi corporate television machine and to come out with something as interesting as this movie is. So and it's an early formative experience, so I'm sure it's, you know, a big deal.
It was NBC, by the way.
NBC, my bad. Yeah, but it's neat to see him light up a little bit, and I can see why he remembers this one fondly. Any last thoughts on Someone's Watching Me?
I'm just really glad I finally got around to seeing this. On one hand, I'm like, oh, I should have seen this years ago. On the other hand, it's fun to continue discovering quote unquote new material from your favorite filmmakers. And I think that's the big reason why I love Blu-rays so much, is you might miss out on something. It came out before you were born or when you're young, or maybe it just never had a good release. And then next thing you know, there's like a fancy 2K scan of a TV movie from the 70s. And it's a treasure.
I agree 100%. Yeah, Blu-rays are pretty great. I might do a podcast about... Wait a minute.
What?
Anyway.
I think you got thesis.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie, so much for sitting down with me again, for watching some Blu-rays and you know, talking about special features. I love to geek out on this stuff with you because I know you appreciate it. And I think we have some people that listen to the show that appreciate people geeking out on stuff. Because, like, really, how many people can you geek out about Blu-ray stuff to? You know, like, I have friends that are movie fans. Like, my coworkers are movie fans. But they're not necessarily as excited about Blu-ray special features. So it's kind of a...
What?
Surprising. So it's kind of a niche thing. So it's nice to have these conversations. I find it cathartic and always fun. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I have movie fans in my life, but they're like, yeah, I'll just rip it and put it on a drive and that's fine. I'm like, well, okay. I'll take my disc and go home.
Yeah, we love the discs. Well, folks, hopefully you get a chance to check these out. I think we would say both are worthwhile pickups, right, Steph?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So more great work from Scream Factory. Support Scream Factory because I want them to keep doing what they're doing. And, you know, they need to be supported. So everybody have a lovely and Blu-ray filled week. And we'll talk to you very soon. Bye-bye.